Let's start off talking about who's on our panel here. I'm your moderator. I'm Evan Hamilton. I'm community manager at User Voice. We make customer service tools that don't suck. And I spend all day trying to make customers happy and dealing with the fact that we have paid customers, we have free customers, we have customers from big name companies and nobodies, and how to balance all of that.
Hi, everyone. My name is Maria. On Twitter, I'm known as The Maria, and I run community and social for Yammer. And internally at Yammer, I make sure that, first of all, everyone at the company is aligned on what our social brand represents, because it's your employees and your customers that really determine your brand these days. And also, I build spaces where customers can talk to each other, because that's really what it's all about.
Hi, my name's Megan Berry, on Twitter, at Megan Berry, which is probably hard to figure out. And I recently founded a company called Lyft 5 to help startups build community and momentum around what they're doing. It's partnered with Lair Ventures in New York, and it's been going for about a month, but it's been great so far. And before that, I started at Clout as the fourth employee and helped build their community and marketing efforts for the past 2 years, including helping to develop the Clout Perks program to help brands engage influencers.
And hi, my name is Frank Eliason. I'm Senior Vice President of Social Media for Citibank, because everybody loves to talk about the bank. And prior to that, many of you may have known me while I was at Comcast, because I'm just a glutton for punishment for a lot of things. So I was originally Comcast Cares. I also have a book coming out called At Your Service, which will be out in April.
So I want to start with this sort of basic question, get it out of the way. What is influence? And I'm going to make Megan speak to that because she's been doing it professionally for several years. So,
yeah, so at Clout, and I think I personally agree with it as well, we define influence as the ability to drive action. And I think, you know, from a business perspective, that's what you're interested in, that your influencers are the people who can drive action for you in some way, whether that be, you know, measured through that social online influence, which is, you know, clicks and retweets and converting people, or, you know, any other type of offline influence and word of mouth.
I agree with that, but also I would challenge all of us to think about influence as a little bit broader, because in social it's notoriously very difficult to measure, so you have to look at a variety of things. Somebody could be very influential in their space, but just not tweet. So you really have to sort of ask yourself a set of questions before you can definitively say if someone, and you never can definitively say so.
See, the way I view things is, you know, the world's shifted. You know, when it used to be, if you were a member of the press, you were highly influential about a company or about anything. So that would meet most definitions of influencer. Today, if you really look around the world and what's happened over, especially in 2011, what do we see? We saw a lot of mass revolutions. You know, so for me, the influence is now hitting the masses as opposed to these individuals. You know, and masses are able to drive things much differently. So I do think it's time we start redefining some of these things, because individual influence really gets, you know, skewed a bit. I did a blog post a while back, you know, around the whole thing that was going on in Egypt. If you really think about it, Libya works too. Muammar Gaddafi would have been an influencer, you know, just like anybody else. They're not around anymore. You know, the fact is, these people, you know, that were really driving one direction, that's not it. The masses took over. So I think there's a little bit of shift that's going on in the world, and social's a huge piece to that.
So do any of you three work with influencers in your daily job?
Yes. So I define influencers as not, to Frank's point, not just the press or people who blog a lot or people who speak publicly. Any one of our customers is in a position to be influential to other customers. So you really can't afford to say that, oh, this guy doesn't have any Twitter followers, so he's not influential. So our customers are actually influential towards each other. And we're B2B, so within our customers, you have people who are influential within their own companies. So, for example, if you piss off that person, they walk and they take like 40,000 users with them. So our setup is a little, so you have to look at your business and understand what the different constituent groups are and who is influential within those groups.
Just to play devil's advocate to that, I do agree, you know, everyone is influential to someone, et cetera. That being said, from a business perspective, if you consider everyone an influencer, it's not that helpful in terms of determining what to do next. So it's useful to think of, depending on the action you need someone to take, who's influential in that area, in that customer base. So if what you want is to build a Twitter presence, it makes sense to look at CloudScore or Twitter followers to try to figure out who you should be connecting with. If what you need is more paying customers, the people on social media might not be the best ones for that, per Maria's point. So it's about targeting like what you want and looking for the factors that align with that.
I think the challenge becomes in, you know, business, and we're all social media users. How often do you really go out and really, you know, hawk companies and, you know, have, you know, spread the word about companies? We're not out there for that. We're out there for, you know, connecting family, friends, to meeting new people. You know, Twitter's a great place for meeting new people. I don't necessarily see us out there trying to, you know, buy things all the time. We may ask our friends and people we trust, you know, what product would you buy? I'm looking for this. But is it this what social media is really used for? And you can look at your own uses of social media. I think marketers have been excited about social media, thinking, oh, we can get everybody buying our product because of the social media. Is that how you're buying product? I personally don't. You know, if Chris Brogan told me to go buy something, I'm probably not going to go buy it. Do I love Chris? Absolutely. Is it going to change what I buy? Probably not. You know, there's, you know, it's about this trust and these aspects to it. And, you know, what influences me is very different than what would influence anybody else that's here. Doesn't mean I disagree with Cloud, because actually I think Cloud's extraordinarily useful. I don't care about the scores per se. I like to joke that, you know, many times on Cloud, I'm listed as being influential on Cloud, and it always cracks me up. But the fact is, I look at Cloud, I think it's fascinating to get information. I find the value in social media is information that is available. So, you know, you can get to know me for who I am. I may not tweet that often, but you can know that when I do Twitter about customer service, I'm highly passionate about it. And, you know, so you can really start to know me if you're a brand. You would also get to understand what things might trigger me. I think there's huge value in that information. Although Clout may not be the perfect example, because when I was writing my book, it said I was influential on Mary Poppins, and I'm still trying to figure that one out. But at the same time, I think there is value in knowing these information, these tidbits about people, because now it allows me to connect to the people I'm working with. You know, if I'm a service person and I know things that interest you, we can have a human connection when we're talking. You know, if I'm developing marketing strategies to market to you, I can get to know more about what interests you and maybe make my marketing fit what influences you or what interests you. So that next flyer you get in the mail, instead of being just something generic, is something that really is about something you're interested in. We have to think differently, and we have to be disruptive to the service worlds that we're in, because I think they're destroying our brands, but also we have to be disruptive to the marketing world that we're in. You know, there's great information in all these places. I think social is a huge win, but we have to get it right, and getting it right is starting to understand who are all these, you know, aspects to things. How do I get to know these people a little bit more intimately?
Fun fact, that's the second time that Mary Poppins has been mentioned at this South By. So she's big on Cloud. Frank, you mentioned customer service, and I remember this story from back at the height of Comcast Cares. For those of you who aren't aware, Frank created at Comcast Cares on Twitter. It was very revolutionary that Comcast would actually be seeking direct contact with customers. And I remember this story, somebody was interviewing you, and at the same time you had two different phones and you were tweeting on both of them. So my question is, you know, should influence be used to determine who you respond to? Because at a certain point, maybe you can't respond to everyone with a brand that big.
Let's look at some examples that are out there. There's fascinating examples. You can look at the example of United Airlines and the, you know, United Breaks Guitar. We didn't really know about him very well beforehand. You can look at Comcast. Comcast has a great historic example, which is someone who did a video of a technician falling asleep. And, you know, that video has been seen by, last time I looked, about 1.75 million people. Yet the person who posted it only posted one other video. And when you search Comcast, that can't used to come up on the first page. You know, so you have to be cautious. I think good content really becomes huge influence in this world. And what resonates with people? You know, what resonates with me? I had a bad service experience last night with Southwest. So what did I do? I wound up Twittering about it. I waited 2 hours in my fourth supervisor before I did that. But, you know, that is the fact is this is the new world in which we live. And, you know, you have to treat everybody equally because you just never know what kind of content they'll have. There's a great example that I wrote about in my book, Kotkin Enterprises. Kotkin Enterprises had an email exchange with someone, and the email exchange at the end of it, one of it, called him, called him the douchiest customer, out of all the customers that complained on this topic. Well, needless to say, someone on that email chain was also someone, you know, so the person who originated that email, he was just a nobody. He was just like you or I. But he did CC some other people, and the person did a reply to all. That got posted on Penny Arcade and went wild. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in the social web. And it started with someone who's just like you or I, a basic customer, and destroyed the brand. I'm hopeful that the brand will be able to come back, and they eventually did respond fairly well. But it's a great example of situations where anybody can really hurt your brand. But since you mentioned Comcast Cares, I do want to mention or say hi to Bill Gerth, who's sitting back there, who's the new Comcast Cares since I left about a year and a half ago. So hi, Bill.
Probably.
He's being quiet.
Using two phones right now, probably. So, Maria, you mentioned having influencers who actually affect many, many, many other people within their organization, which affects the bottom line. Is there a way for you to measure the monetary value of a fan's influence, and do you do that?
Yes. So you should know who your customers are and kind of what their influence is and how their influence is portrayed or transferred onto others. As far as are they always fans, they're not always going to be fans. So you sort of have to do some work to map the people who you talk to in social media to their customer record. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about social CRM and all this stuff that helps you get a better and more intimate look at your relationship with the customer, you know, looking at their tweets, looking at their emails with you, looking at their entire purchase cycle. The tools are largely not there, unfortunately. So it's, you know, you have to sort of take a little bit on faith and try to figure out how to hack it all together. But ultimately, we would all know, like, who the person is when they tweet. Are they a customer? Are they a prospect? And sort of place it in context. So that actually helps you to know how to respond. So when someone tweets at you and you know that they called you four times, okay, you probably better do something about it. But if someone is just complaining and they just have a history of complaining and they tweet you and they say, I hate you so much, and then you write back and you say, well, why? You know, can we work together? Can you help me understand why you hate our brand? And then nothing happens. Okay, so then you place it in context also that this person just likes to complain. But when you ask them to have, you know, productive discourse, they disappear. So it really goes both ways.
Well, I was going to ask you, though, you've been around it a lot. You know, have you seen any companies that really use CRM data that well?
Everyone talks about using
it. I think they talk really well about it, but I don't see it in action very well.
I have to say that we try at Yammer. Like, I always try to, and I ask everyone to, actually, sorry, Megan, to ignore clout, because I don't really care.
I don't work there anymore.
Yeah, we all got worried, because when Megan asked us to be on the panel, she was at clout, and we were all like, can we say that what we really think? And then she said, I left, and we went, oh!
I would love to jump in just on that note, though, which is this idea that you said we have to treat all customers equally. Businesses actually don't do that. If I fly United a lot, I get premier status. There's a better line. I get upgraded without paying for it. People treat me better. There's a different phone number
but
I can call.
That's because you're spending money with them as opposed to because people know who I am, I should be treated differently.
So what it's about for a business is that person's bottom line impact. So if you spend a lot of money, the bottom line impact is really clear. There's this other potential thing out there that I think there's a lot of ways it can be misused, and there's certainly examples of if you have a great story, that will transcend whether you happen to have a lot of Twitter followers. But if you already have a big following, who cares what you say, in that area that matches with the brand, that's something to look at. You can impact their bottom line. So it's about predicting something without as much certainty, but brands should be allowed to think about.
But it sends a message to other customers. One of my favorite examples was, people hit me up for business all the time, and they send me, all these different agencies, and an agency sent me a thing saying, hey, you know what? We did this great program where we gave all these influencers these kits regarding HBO's launch of Game of Thrones. And I went, I've been subscribing to HBO for years. I didn't get one of those kits. I'm ticked. So, there's always this issue. If you treat someone differently here because of their influence, then you're sending a different message to your other customers, which is, you're not important to us. When someone does spend a lot of money with a company and they get other services, people tend to understand that. But if it's simply due to influence as a customer, I'm not going to be too thrilled with it. In fact, I'm going to say, you treat me like dirt. See ya.
Well, please treat your customers nicely. I think the base level shouldn't be your dirt. The base level should be good customer service. But going beyond that, to send a steak to, Peter Shankman, to go to that extra level, that's something different that you can't do for every customer, and it becomes a marketing stunt.
The Peter Shankman situation was a pure PR stunt.
Yeah.
And I actually wrote about that in my book, too. If I Twittered out to Morton's, deliver me a steak at this airport, they're not going to do it. It's a pure PR play. And to me, I think it just shows the bullshit that they are.
So yeah, I want to... Go ahead.
So one quick
I forgot
thing.
The buzzer.
So one quick thing. I think the key issue here is that you have an experience that you give to your customers, right? Mm-hmm. So if you give people a great experience on Twitter because they have a lot of followers, but you have shit experience everywhere else, that's going to show. And there's no amount of steak or free stuff that you can send to people if your basic experience sucks.
Definitely. Yeah.
Then it's just PR, and it's just you grasping at straws, and it doesn't actually solve the problem. So I think before you do any steak or anything, right?
Wait, I'm
you
still
have
trying to get a steak,
your...
though. So, I really want to get a steak.
So I want to take a totally agree with those
potatoes.
Points. Customer service should not be based on influence. But let's take a step back to we were talking about how much people pay. And a very popular model, especially for startups, is the freemium model. User Voice is built off of the freemium model. We have a free plan, and then we have paid plans, and we have customers on both. And the hope is that people who are not paying start paying. Do you treat those customers differently? I mean, one group of them is not paying you money and may never pay you money, and then there's another group that is paying. Do you treat them differently? Treat them exactly the same?
I feel like I talk way too much. But I think that you do see that, though. I think there's many that do give some type of service where the people paying get easier service than someone who gets the free service. It might be a little harder for them to get to it. I think there's ways to do that and be fair. If I'm not paying for an app, I'm fine with getting ads. I'm also fine with maybe not getting service because I didn't pay you anything anyway.
Does that need to be explicit, though? Like,
I think you have to be honest. You have to tell it. Here's exactly what you can expect from us. And I think this is where companies more or less fail, is they're not good at saying, here's what you can expect from us. And I think that is the crux of the issue with brands. Their marketing message typically is, we treat everybody great, blah, 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 instead of being real. Here's what you can expect from us. I think people are actually very open and accepting of, here's what you can expect from us. I know I am.
Yeah, I think we've gone through decades of being a little, or more than a little, opaque as businesses. And now that social sort of forces you out of that, I think there is still an approach of, you know, we'll just put our marketing message out there and we'll just use Twitter to send the same message, which obviously doesn't translate. So if you are willing to play the social game, and if you're really committed to it, you have to be transparent first and really respect your customers enough to tell them what the real deal is. So we actually have a freemium service, and we do have a different SLA for premium customers, and we're pretty upfront. We say, you know, when you're a premium customer, you know, we get back to you within, you know, this amount of time. We won't resolve it. We can't promise that, but we will get back to you. So it does matter, but also you have to understand where you are with that particular company as they move from a prospect to a customer. And, you know, I mean, it's very contextual. So
it sounds like we're all in agreement. Ooh, all right. We're all in agreement that, you know, providing good customer service should just be a baseline. But what about dealing with people who are complaining? So let's dive into some case studies. The first one would be Alec Baldwin and American Airlines. If you haven't heard the story, he was playing Words with Friends, which they loved, and he wouldn't turn off his phone, and they were going to take off. So here you have someone who's influential. They probably pay a lot of money. I'm sure he flies first class. I'm sure he flies with the same airline. But he's doing something he's not supposed to. Should they have treated him differently? Because they told him he had to turn it off. He tweeted about it. It became a huge firestorm. Should that have happened?
Yes.
My understanding is that that's legally they have to do that. So I would never say a business should do something illegal for an influencer. So I think, I mean, when I hear that, I respect the airline attendant who actually went up to Alec Baldwin and was like, dear sir, we cannot treat you differently. You have to also turn off your phone like all the rest of us, even though we may privately feel that that is a weird rule and it's probably not legit. That's what they have to say to everyone, right? And Alec Baldwin should have to do it too. When things are set out, like to that expectations game, you don't get a different rules because you're Alec Baldwin, although I guess in a lot of situations you do.
In many ways, he was extremely disrespectful for the people that were there. They were very clear to the rules, and we all know the rules. We fly all the time. You know, I've watched Mythbusters. I know it's, you know, a bunch of BS, and it's sometimes I laugh at it, but you know what? I still shut off my stupid phone. I can wait a few minutes. You know, so I applaud them for doing the right thing.
I think, you know, the whole democratization of social media and everyone having a voice is a great thing, but we have to be careful not to swing too far the other way. And so I would like to challenge businesses and customers to respect each other. And I think as companies, if we want to bend too far the other way, we're actually doing a disservice to the entire ecosystem. So if someone, you know, shows up on Twitter and is just bashing you for no reason, they're being disrespectful, it's up to you as a business to also push back. But again, like you would push back in the same way that you would push back if someone was disrespectful to you on the phone, in person, and in other channels. It's basically, we need to sort of extend how we have talked to our customers and into a different channel.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I also agree that everything in business tends to be a pendulum. We tend to go extremes. You know, if you really look at marketing extremes, like, you know, Mad Men of the world, that was there. What I'll also tell you, though, is unfortunately, I think businesses did take it to extremes from a marketing and PR perspective, and I think customers said, enough of this already, and customers will take it to an extreme. I do think that it would be more ideal to be in the center. I don't think that's what's going to happen. I think no matter what, customers are going to say, I have control over your brand. And beyond the customers, we've talked about this before, employees control your brand. And they're going to take it all the way over there, too, because they're tired of being treated in certain ways. So I think that, you know, the ideal scenario is that we end up down here, but I think it's going to go all the way over.
Yeah. Well, this is why you have to treat the problem at the root of the problem. You have to fix your experience first. And, you know, beyond that...
And usually the experience, at least from, you know, dealing with call centers for years and stuff like that, starts with the employee and how you treat your own employees. You value your brand. You want people to share things and like things, but then you treat your own employees like hell? Yeah, I don't think so. You know, I think it starts there, and unfortunately, I think that is where at least big business has been lacking for a long time.
To add to that, I mean, I think that that is actually how you reach to the middle in that sense, like that middle of the pendulum is when people had issues with clout, which we certainly have a lot of controversy associated with that brand, as you might have noticed. And when I reached out as a person that like, hey, this is why I actually do think clout is a really interesting concept when used in this way and can be helpful in this way. And here's how I can help you think about it, that we actually don't think one number is your whole person and now you just walk around to us as one number and that's it. And actually having that person-to-person connection with someone, like you say, who actually believes in what they're doing as opposed to just doing it because they're paid to and hate their job. And that, I think, is where you get that connection, where suddenly that customer who was being really mean to the brand account is like, oh, I'm actually dealing with a person. And it's like suddenly it kicks in, and they're like, oh, I should be nice and like talk and have a real discussion. And that's where you get there.
Oh, I fully agree with you. I actually think social customer service is a complete failure. And I think it's a complete failure because companies fail to realize the personal connections that are necessary and do happen. You know, and also the improvements that happen on the back end, which they didn't see that we were doing at Comcast, they didn't see Dell doing. You know, they missed so many pieces of the puzzle. They just went out and said, I need to do this because our customers want it. Your customers don't want social service. Your customers want you to get it right the first time. You know, give me a break. You know, this is not brain surgery, guys.
So let's talk about another example. I'm back. So Zappos, I know Zappos, everyone take a shot. Zappos is known for doing a lot of great things for their customers. One of my favorite examples is, you know, they find out that a customer's, you know, family member just died, they send them flowers. And that's wonderful, and that's a great connection to your customers. But I'm wondering if that scales. And we touched on this a little bit earlier, but if I hear that story and then my family member dies and I'm, you know, buying shoes off Zappos and I don't get flowers, is that then a neutral experience to me? Am I like, well, that's fine? Or is it negative? And I'm actually like, well, why did Zappos care about that person, not me?
I think actually they chose, and maybe they do other things that don't work quite as well, but that is a great example of something that, one, you normally keep quiet. So if a company just finds out about it out of the blue, it's weird, actually. So they are limiting it to people who've chosen to share this publicly, so that is already limiting, and people who shared it with Zappos. So I think they have created something, and no one's going to, like, oh, I really want flowers, so I'm going to say a family member died. Like, no, you're probably not going to do that. So I think that
how I get flowers every Valentine's Day, for the record.
Except for Evan. So they've really narrowed in on something
for me.
that is meaningful, I think, but also something that's not going to go crazy and you know, make it impossible for them to scale it, so to speak.
Well, I was going to say, you know, it really comes down to, again, I'm going to keep coming back to the culture that you have in your call center and whatnot, you know, because the way they do it, I worked for a company that's no longer in business. It's not my fault. But you know, I actually saw the writing on the wall, and that's why I went to Comcast. But anyway, we actually did do some unique things, including exactly what they do at Zappos. So I actually know for a fact that it scales, but it actually requires empowering your own employees to be able to do things, to be able to say, you know what, I have a situation here where, you know, I want to send this customer candy or flowers. Our agents were able to do that, you know, for, you know, they could spend up to $25 for, I think it was, you know, 10 customers a month, and they got to choose when they did it. So you can do different things and empower them to do it. And that's really what Zappos does. They empower their people to say it's the right thing to do. The problem is, in most service departments, is we don't empower our people at all. They can't make a decision. They have to stick to the process. They have to stick to this, that, or the other thing. And, you know, they can't think outside the box. You know, we actually used to give them cards. We refer to them as startle cards. God, I'm giving away my whole stupid book. the startle cards, though, were literally Hallmark cards. We bought them at Hallmark. And they actually never said the brand on it at all. And they were blank. They were given them on their desks and said, if you ever have a situation where you want to write to someone, you know, whether it be something that happened during the call or something they said, just do it. You don't need our permission. By the way, this was a bank, so regulated business. So anybody who goes over the regulated BS, you know, the fact is you can do these things. You can empower your people, and we did that. And the employees loved it. And by the way, the company would get great press out of doing it as well, although quite, because it was a small company, but it would show up in, like, the Washington Post. One of the ones that showed up there was a horribly written card. And it was really funny. I remember seeing the picture in the paper going, oh, my God, we sent that out? And then I read the paper. Then I read the article. And the guy who wrote the article was like, oh, my God, this was the greatest experience in my life. And see how real this is. It taught me a lot. And it taught me a lot about, you know, really, people love those human connections. And if you look at the best calls, and I'll challenge anybody, you want to figure out what the best service experiences are. Your best service experiences have never been when you call up and they efficiently handled what you asked for. That's not your best service experience. That's not memorable to you. What is memorable to you is very easy. It is about a human connection. It's that waiter who said something nice or sat there with you or played with your kids or did something along those lines. It's that call where that person started talking to you about other things and you realized we had something in common and you were talking about that when all they were doing was trying to kill time while their system worked. But it wound up being this human connection that happened. And businesses have lost that human connection, whether it be to their employees or to their own customers. And now we have to bring that back.
We certainly have the tools because yes. That's what social is, right? All the community tools and social tools. It's not about connecting the company to people. It's connecting the people from the company to the people who are your customers. So I think it all, you hit on something brilliantly. I think it all goes back to intent. Is your intent to do PR and send stakes? I know we're going to talk a lot about stakes.
I still want the stakes.
I know. It's getting to that time, I think, at 5:30. But are you actually doing it for the purpose of building that intimacy? And I know we all talk about intimacy, but the real true intimacy, it's the one that's done for the right reasons. It's not for PR. It's not with the expectations that you're going to tweet about it. It's just to make you feel whole.
If you look at Comcast, every one of their service people that they Twitter out with from their own handle. One of my favorites is Comcast Melissa. She's holding her baby, and the baby, I've watched the baby grow up on the pictures that she's changed her avatar. And that all came from a story. And so, you know, the reason why that happened, so when we launched on Twitter April of 2008, was it? Yeah, April 2008. And it was me. I was Comcast Cares. I did it like most other businesses. It was Comcast. It was very official, blah, 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 blah. You know, and every day I was actually, you know, the only one out there. And, you know, so I was out there some days from 6 in the morning till 2 in the morning, almost every day. And, you know, I did it 7 days a week. And then one Saturday I said, you know what? Hey, guys, on Friday, I said, guys, tomorrow I can't be out here. I'm sorry, but tomorrow, July 26th, I can't. I'll certainly check back with you on Sunday, but tomorrow I'm not going to be there. I didn't get into why. The real reason why was it was the only day I could have my birthday party for our daughter. But with the real, you know, what they found out, and one of the most amazing things happened. So we all know how people feel about the cable company, right? You know, I don't care who your cable provider is. You probably curse them out some days. They connect you to the world. It's a thing about passion about that. But anyway. Not the purpose of this conversation. But what happened was, you know, as you know, I couldn't be out there, and I got through the day. At the end of the day, I looked through the feed, and I saw the most amazing thing. People that did not work for Comcast, they were saying, let's let Comcast Cares have his day. Can I help you? Here, let me do this. Now, do you want to know why? They Googled my name. I don't even think my name was on there at the time. But I was in some press that happened like right away when I was on there, so they knew my name. They Googled my name. They found my family website. That day was the anniversary of my daughter's death, a different daughter. And that's why they assumed I wasn't going to be out there. Would you do that for your cable company? Would you do that for any company? There is a different world that we're in. And it was from that point forward that I knew it had to be separate individualized accounts. And this is where, you know, if you really pay attention to the successes early in social media, I knew all the people that were out there back then. We always knew the people behind things. We knew who the people were. I knew it was Brad Nelson at Starbucks. I, you know, knew the people at JetBlue. I knew the people at Southwest. We knew everybody. And that scales. It's not, I'm not saying it's easy to scale, but it scales because companies have to let loose a little. They have to have a risk of someone like a Frank leaving. I probably did more to hurt my cause in terms of social media when I left Comcast. I think Comcast handled it beautifully, by the way. But that caused fear in companies. The fear's misguided. The fact that Comcast and I had the chance to be together, I love Comcast to this day. I love the people I work with. I miss them every single day. You know, it's all these human connections. Sorry.
So I want to go over one more case study, and then we're going to do questions. So get your questions ready. And this is sort of influencers gone wrong. Wikipedia has had a lot of success through curating these fantastic people and maintaining these relationships with people who do a lot of edits in Wikipedia. I can't remember the percentages, but it's an extremely small percentage that actually edits anything and posts anything on Wikipedia. The problem is now a lot of people are finding it nearly impossible to get involved in that community and start becoming an editor because these highly influential sort of click of editors will come in and say, no, that's wrong, that's incorrect, you know, you didn't do your research. And there's obviously a trade-off between the two. Is there a point at which you give influencers too much power and new members can't join?
So you definitely want to empower the community to sort of establish its own norms, and you have to have a clear pathway to, okay, so you start out as a newbie, and then you, through your contributions, you sort of rise through the community. That's how a community is structured, right? So you, but again, you have to be very clear from the beginning of like how you get from point A to point B. As far as being too clicky, I feel like that does some disservice to the community because it incentivizes people from ever contributing. And so you get into this echo chamber of people who were there early, who were talking to themselves, you know, and they're similar. So you do have to, that's what community management is about. It's about architecting the space where ideas flow freely and they're not too dependent on one or two people. Like when Frank leaves, then you're housed. You don't ever want to do that. You want to have a system where, you know, ideas can sort of filter through and you want to have a true democracy. At the same time, you know, it's a fine line to walk between, you know, the democracy and everybody contributes to curating content to the point where it is truly valuable and truly useful. So I think that's an interesting community management challenge more than anything.
Yeah, to add to that, I mean, I think I personally have found enormous success with just asking those people for help. So not knowing, you know, Wikipedia's perspective, if this is something that's like, oh no, we're not getting enough new editors, this could impact Wikipedia's future. Actually just finding those people who probably love Wikipedia and saying like, hey, like, if, you know, let's talk to a few of you one-on-one and explain the problem. And you know this better than anyone else. Help us think of a solution. Usually people are really flattered that you're asking and they have the best solutions.
All right, well, we're going to take questions now. There's a mic right up there, so please just stand in a line behind it, and whoever has the highest clout score gets to go first.
Hi, I'm Mike Bell. My clout score is 65.
All right, you're okay then.
So question for Maria. I'm involved in a lot of Yammer communities and other type of communities on Facebook. So you mentioned something about influence. We've talked a lot about influence. Have you used, because a lot of people put their Twitter account in Yammer as well. Have you mapped Yammer leaderboards to Twitter accounts and cloud scores?
Yes.
I can neither confirm nor deny that.
It's yes, but it's also a little bit more challenging technically. So, but yeah, we're moving to a place where we can map that full customer picture of when you tweet. Then we're able to understand who you are and look into your Salesforce account. So we do a lot of this stuff manually. I hate to say it, just because the tools are sort of not there. But we're hacking our way into that intimacy. Does that help?
Hi, my name is Isabella Usarek. Last I checked, my clout score is 42, and I'm pissed that I couldn't get into the clout party. But anyway, I'm sure by the end of South by it will be 50. So my question is, like, I'm really moved by the Comcast story and how you could actually take a day off. And that it inspired you to have, or, you know, your strategy for support is to have everyone have a unique Twitter handle. But you know, I work for enterprise customers. We're B2B. So the main question is, how does that scale?
Sure. It scales. Well, first of all, it starts with your own employee base. It starts with the right tools, and it starts with, you know, having a plan. So once we went to having separate Twitter handles, we certainly talked through how are we going to handle things like DMs? How are we going to handle, you know, who's going to be on at what time? You know, and that way we can make sure we're connecting those dots, which we've done for, they've done for years and still do to this day. At the same time, we're starting to get tools that are equipped to actually handle the multiple Twitter handles, which makes it much, much easier. And I think that's been one of the challenges. I think the other piece to it is, though, it's more to the comfort level of the company. You know, because, you know, what people fail to realize, one of the fascinating things is when I was at Comcast, I had one Twitter handle. It was Comcast Cares. I did not have Frank Eliason and Comcast Cares. I never got Frank Eliason until right as I left. I did all my tweets from Comcast Cares. It was part of that human connection that goes on. So it's getting comfortable as companies that, you know, our people are connected out there. They are going to have dialogue. They are going to talk about other things. People would always ask me, well, why is that it? Now, what happens when you Twitter something that's offensive for the company? And my point was, does it matter if I'm using Comcast Cares as Frank Eliason or if it's my Twitter handle, Frank Eliason? It still reflects on the company. You know, it's simple as that. We're connected together in a much different way. And that connection is difficult for companies to take. They don't know how to deal with it. Unfortunately, I think there's people that have abused it on out there that make it bad, you know, such as people, you know, stealing Twitter handles when people aren't comfortable with it. And I think those are things that are a problem. At the same time, if you really think about the world in which we live, most companies you work for, I'm guessing a lot of you, your company gives you a phone. Why? Because they want you connected at all times. The world has meshed. The company started that. I didn't. And, you know, it's also understanding those things, too. And it's understanding the psychology of all this. So we're a long way away. But where I've always seen social media, when you look at success stories, Zappos is the true success story. And, you know, everybody has to drink for saying Zappos, and I'll be the first to do it. But, you know, people always look at all these things that go on. Why is Zappos looked upon as the leader? Well, they're a leader out there because they encourage all their people to be out there. They don't tell them what to say. It creates this mass influence as opposed to this individual who's an influence. It creates this environment where, you know, it's 6 degrees of separation. Somehow I'm connected to someone at Zappos no matter what. It's fairly easy that way. And that connection is really strong. So it's finding new ways to work as a business. It's starting to train your employees how to use social media, training them how they do impact the brand when they do things that are stupid. So hopefully they avoid doing the stupid things. But also allows the brand to excel because now you're all these human beings. You're a humanized brand. You're all together. It's what you are anyway, just now it's actually seen that way, and you're seeing yourself that way. Fascinating aspects to it.
Great, thank you.
Hi, Jeb Ory with 5 Degrees. Question for the whole panel, but probably most specifically for Evan and Megan. So as an early stage company, what advice do you have to people, both pre-product and very early stages of open beta, in terms of building community and keeping your early evangelists really excited and happy about the product and not pissing off people that are expecting more full-featured products?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're early on, some of the problems we discussed here about scaling, for better or for worse, don't apply. And you're really trying hard to connect with anyone who has some connection with the product. And you start out, you know, depending on how early it is, you start out with everyone you and whoever else is working on the project knows. And you branch out from there and find the people that are connecting with it and use their feedback to make the product better, to have the product ideally be something that's starting to spread on its own. I always try to think about the places in the product where you can, people might want to share anyway, and if you can help them with that, that's a big thing I've found helps. But in general, it's about doing those one-on-one connections and really even don't worry about, oh, is this going to scale? Because nothing's going to scale if no one cares about what you're doing. So first project is to get the first person to care, and then it's to get the 10th person to care, and you have to build from there.
I think also just making sure you have the right initial audience. I think a lot of people invite their friends and family, and I saw some panel, I don't remember which one, earlier this week that said that's really dumb. Unless your friends and family are the target audience, they're going to give you the wrong feedback. They're not going to want to use your product because they're not, you know, a B2B company. So making sure that if you're fostering that initial community, it's a community of people who actually have a need for your product.
So your job is actually to... your job is actually to create a space where customers can help other customers and feel a reward for doing so. And that's like really the best way to scale. And your job as the community manager is to help customers tell their stories and elicit those stories and give them a space to share. And that's really what ignites the community. It's the stories. It's nothing that you can do as a company to your customer. You have to enable your customers to do it.
Thank you.
Hey, my name is Mariah. I just have a quick question. I know that Frank talked a little bit sort of about modeling and also about giving employees a certain level of autonomy, which I think is really important in any sort of back and forth and relationship building. You've also spoken, I think, Megan, a little bit to sort of the product feedback loop and how to pivot and adjust with that. But what I'm really interested in is if anyone has any additional thoughts on how, as a community manager or however you choose to define that role, you can help to define and influence the culture, not just of employees, but of the community overall. Do you think that it's more design-oriented? Do you just serve as a model? Or are there specific initiatives that you would undertake?
Maria just said it, and it's something I hit on in my book quite a bit. Companies themselves have been all about metrics, right? Everything's metrics. I'm going to be the first to tell you metrics are bull. Sorry, I know there's a lot of people out there that, you know, but people choose the metrics to tell the story they want to tell. You know, that's human nature. It's what we do. By the way, just like people choosing metrics to show that might not show the right thing, people looking at the metrics glaze over them. They don't tell anything. You really want to drive change in your company? Change comes from one thing: stories. So where you're just talking about stories, that it's something I hit on in my book. If you want to drive change in your organization, if you want to change the culture of your organization, you start sharing stories. I have yet to meet a CEO who wanted to create a bad experience for a customer. You know, I've been looking. You know, but the fact is, you know, they didn't know. You know, all of a sudden they hear a story and it hits home. Oh my God, we did that? Yeah, it's been in the numbers all over the place for a long time. You just didn't see it. But because you say it in a story, now I have a human relationship to it. So one of the things we did at Comcast, I also did at my prior company before that, and I also do at Citi, is it's all about sharing stories. And we share stories regularly, but we share stories with the intent to drive change. So I am trying to get onto your emotional side of things. I'm trying to share a story with, you know, maybe lower level employees to help them rise up a little bit. I'm trying to share stories of customers to senior level employees because I want them to know the experience they're creating when they're making these decisions. Everything I always do, I actually try to focus more on the story than the numbers. You know, to me, it always comes back to when I was first trained on Six Sigma. It's all about metrics, and you're supposed to let the metrics guide you what you would do. And I watch all these people doing Six Sigma projects, and they would always choose numbers that really told whatever they wanted in their heart. Like, okay, that it told me back then that numbers were just stupid, And, you know, I take that to this day, and I focus on stories. But the best part, if you're a community manager, or if you're the person who's searching the net and listening on the net, you have, or if you're just a service person, you have access to some of the greatest stories to drive change in your organization. You just now need to find a way to kind of share those stories and do it in a way that, you know, drives influence. And that those stories, just like I said earlier, content really is what goes viral. Same thing internally, content. If you have a good, powerful story, you can drive tons of change.
So I completely agree with that. Just to add a little bit, though, to that, I found personally I've worked with a lot of product people that are very numbers focused. So while I think it's always about stories, sometimes you have to use the data to tell your story depending on who your audience is. And I think especially, you know, in startups, you're interfacing directly with the product person and you're really trying to get across why they should care about your community. And the CEO is often more influenced by the beautiful story than the product person who's like, I'm looking at 70 different numbers and I don't see this and I don't care about your one person. And so you have to know who you're trying to convince internally and give them the story that will speak to them. And sometimes that's data-driven and sometimes it's people.
I was also going to say that whenever you're dealing with product people, always recognize a key thing. They're extraordinarily proud of their product. And it doesn't matter what business you're in. They don't like hearing bad news on their product. They don't like someone saying anything negative about their product. Also recognize who your audience is and use that to your advantage. You know, because, you know, it's important to recognize where they're coming from so you can figure out the best way to position it back to them. And sometimes that's just asking the right questions.
Great. I think we got one more.
Hi, I'm Honey. I have a blog with about 100,000 visitors a day. And I sometimes get negative comments from people. And the problem is, the golden rule in blogging is don't feed a troll. So if someone complains, don't say anything. Just let them. The only thing they want is attention, and you don't want to give it to them. But I also see that if I talk back to people and ask what's your problem and why are you complaining, that they're really willing to get into a conversation. But that's a problem for me because my main business is blogging and not customer service. I don't have a budget to get customer service people. What advice do you give? I don't know a lot of history about these people. I can't look up if they're influential or sometimes they use nicknames, sometimes they're anonymous. What kind of advice do you give?
I'd say ideally what you'd want to create is, to Maria's point earlier, a community where people help each other so that it's not just when anyone has a problem or a question, you're the only one who responds, but maybe contacting those few people who can start it. You have limited time, so find a few who are friendly and say, you know, this is what I'm trying to do. Maybe you can help this person. And trying to create something where there is a dynamic conversation going on as opposed to a one-to-one, like, here's a problem that you are the only one who can solve because that doesn't scale.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, as much as you want community members to talk to each other, sometimes people do just want to hear from the company. And so you sort of have to discern, like, is this a problem that only you can solve? And oftentimes, most of the time, when people are tweeting or commenting or posting anything negative, they just want to be heard. Of course, they're trolls, and they have a whole different set of motivations, so yes, ignore them. But I found that usually when someone is upset, ask them why. And based on that, you help solve their problem or not, and be very honest if this is a problem that you cannot solve. There's nothing worse than saying you're going to solve it and then not doing it. That actually creates even more negativity. But ask, and actually by converting people who are upset into people who love you, that's the most rewarding and long-lasting effect that you can actually do. And understand that when people are negative, when they're speaking out, you're actually lucky that they spoke out because they are passionate and they took the time to tell you how they feel. So it's your job to take them from passionate and negative to passionate and positive. And that's what advocacy is.
I agree. I think that, you know, one of the things I'll say, though, is Craig Newmark has on his business card customer service representative. For those that don't know Craig, he's the founder of Craigslist. Today, if you're dealing with the public, we're all customer service representatives. You know, if you're dealing with your customer base in any way, shape, or form, whether it's your job or not, whether the company supports it, that's the reality. You know, so it's finding things that work. Now, why do people do it? Yes, there are trolls out there. Most of the time, they're trying to get heard because no one's listening to them in different other spaces. You have to give them a means to be heard. Now, there may be benefits to taking it offline. Maybe it's even guiding them to the right place. But, you know, it's also ensuring that they get heard. And, you know, so don't be afraid to write back to them. Don't be afraid to guide them to email. Or sometimes I'll even give out my email address. Can I handle every little thing? Probably not. But I'll get it to the right people, and I'll just forward it. Mm-hmm. But by doing it, it kind of personalizes it to them and then also gives me a little insight as to what happens, because then all of a sudden I'm gaining that story, and now I can start to drive change in that organization instead of getting it where they're spamming my, you know, or trolling my different community aspects. So find what it is that they're really doing. You know, a lot of times we assume that they're trolling. Most of the time I find they wind up are really just frustrated, and they want someone to listen, and they don't care who it is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, find a way to deal with that, and then once you have that feedback from them, drive that change to get your organization to provide a means for customers to give them feedback that's off the block, you know, or start blogging about stuff that comes from that, because guess what? You also get the greatest content from some of those feedback things, and I think companies fail to realize that.
Thank you.
All right, we have time for one more quick question. Unfortunately, we're not going to have time for the lightning round, but if anyone wants to come press these buttons afterwards, you're welcome to.
Okay, I just had a question for Frank. I was hoping you could clarify and maybe expand a little bit on something you said earlier about social customer service being a failure. I just want to understand where you're coming from and what you mean exactly.
Wow. That's a good chunk in my book. So I expand on it quite a bit. All right, so why is it a failure? You know, what I've seen go on since we started the Comcast Cares effort, you know, and we ran ours from the service department. I worked in customer service at Comcast. Did we work closely with PR? Yes. But the fact is we worked in customer service. I've watched a lot of companies since then create these social customer service efforts. A lot of times they're either run by marketing, they're run by PR, and I had one firm and one large company say, yeah, but we can't let our service people do it. We don't trust them speaking out there. Like, okay, that sends a message to me loud and clear. Thank you very much. So, you know, they're running it from these PR perspectives. They're doing it in a means to try and shut their customer up. But really what's going on is this. Customers are complaining, and they're doing whatever they can to get that to quiet down. Sometimes even breaking the rules, treating people differently than they would through other channels. Now, this is not the sharpest move. You know, if you think about it, you treat customers in social media differently than you do in other channels, what are you doing? You're telling customers the only way they can get help is to blast their brand publicly. So you're going to drive more people to social media to actually get help. It's this roundabout, vicious cycle. You know, what they have to recognize is if customers are usually first and foremost loud in social media, it's usually because they're frustrated by your other service means. You know, I haven't really met too many people who really want to blast brands. The reason why they blast brands is because they're frustrated by the experiences that those brands create for them. And then, you know, when you do have social customer service, you have to fix these core issues. I shouldn't see the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. You know, you have to come back and start fixing them. You know, you have to drive that change. Now, the other problem is when they are even run by the service department, the service department, there's a problem in service leadership that, you know, they don't typically manage upward very well. Company says, oh, you need to cut $1 million. They go, okay. And they cut $1 million. They're not good at going, if we cut $1 million, here's what it's going to do to the customer experience. They're not good at speaking that way. And, you know, so the problem is in these service organizations, because they're not willing to share what's really happening, you know, when they share calls upward, if you ever have a chance, ask your service departments to share some calls with you. you'll be shared the best calls. They'll sit you next to an agent who's the best agent that's there. Why? You can't see the reality of things. God forbid.
So, you know, Frank, I'm going to have to interrupt you because, unfortunately, we're out of time. You'll have to read the rest of it in his book.
Sorry for the pitches on the book.
Yeah, there's a mass in here in like 20 minutes, I think, so we have to leave. But you can find me at Evan Hamilton, at Maria, Maria, sorry, at Megan Berry, at Frank Eliason. Thank you so much for coming out. We really appreciate it.